Ralph Milton is the author of the Children's Story Bible that we have used for many years at Assembly to give our first graders, though we have made a change from this Bible. He says, "I'm a storyteller, not a theologian or a Bible scholar. The two most important things I bring to the task of telling Bible stories are imagination and passion. I believe that God wants us to be joyful, just, and caring people. One of the ways, but by no means the only way, that God chooses to help us be that kind of people is to encourage a particular people at a particular time to record the stories of their struggles and sorrows, their joys and hope. So enjoy each story, the inner truth, the wisdom that lives in the story. Be open to the flash of insight into what it means to be a spiritual human being who live in a family and a community with other spiritual beings." I have to admit, this week when I read the lectionary texts, I didn't feel that these stories were very compelling. I didn't find them easy to connect with. And so I turned and read various versions and translations. And finally, I settled on the one by Ralph Milton. And I would like to share the story you just heard in his words. It's from the lectionary story Bible, not in your regular one that you'll find at home. After Jesus died, he became alive again in a new way. And he talked to his friends and asked them to stay together so they could be God's people. "I'm going to live with God again, so now it's your job to keep on telling my story." Jesus' friends were not very sure what to do. Jesus wasn't there to help them. They were still afraid that the soldiers would come and get them. "Let's go back to Jerusalem," they said. "We can go to that big house, the one with the room upstairs. We need to plan with each other so we know what to do." It was a little bit crowded in that room because there were 120 people. All of them were Jesus' friends and followers. People stood on the stairs near the big room, the end of the big room. He had to talk very loudly so everyone could hear him. "My friends," he said, "there's something important we have to do. You all know that Jesus chose 12 of his disciples to be his apostles. Apostles are special, are people who are special leaders that help us live God's way. One of those apostles was Judas, but he decided he didn't want to be Jesus' friend anymore, so we have to choose someone else." "That will be very hard to do," said Mary of Magdala. "It should be someone who was with Jesus right from the time he was baptized by John in the river." "That's a good idea," said Peter. "This new apostle should also be a person who saw Jesus alive again after the soldiers had killed him." So all the friends of Jesus talked to each other, and finally they decided that there were two people who could take the place of Judas, Justus and Matthias. "How can we choose between them?" Peter asked. "They are both kind and good people who try hard to live God's way." "I have an idea," said Mary. "Let's write their names, each on a small stone, and we'll put the two stones in a bowl. We'll say a prayer, and God can help us choose the right person. So Mary prayed out loud. "Dear God, you can see into our hearts. When we pick one name out of the bowl, make it the one who should become your new apostle." Then Mary closed her eyes tight and reached in the bowl. The name she picked was Matthias, and that's how Matthias became one of the apostles. I like that one. And it includes that character of Mary that we heard of a couple weeks ago. Mary, who we have heard about anew here, who perhaps in your listening and hearing of the text this week, following the wonderful work of the Wisdom Group, perhaps you said, "Mary, of course it should be Mary." Mary, whose name we still know, these other two, Matthias, and the non-chosen alternative, Barsabbas, who was called Justus, who are they even? All of the importance in making this discernment and bringing the number back up to 12 and we don't hear about either of them again. So I have to imagine who they are. And I think that they were maybe just ordinary, faithful people. People who had apparently been with Jesus for a long time. People who, while at the middle of the things, don't have stories that we ever hear. People who, like you or I or Mary or whomever, impact their community, even though we don't know it, years later. I wonder how Barsabbas felt about not being chosen. I wonder whether he continued his ministry. I hope he did. He had gifts and he was selected. I hope he did not set them aside. And I like to imagine that he joined the wave of ordinary people. The ordinary people who have been the ones who have carried this wild and extraordinary gospel from one generation to the next, building the story of faith for those who would come after. When I step back and think about it then, what is amazing about this story is that it's included at all. It's a story of two people who later don't matter, because we don't hear about them again. But in every way, they do matter, because they're the story of each of us, the story of the community of the ordinary, the story of a community figuring out what to do next, how to be the body of Christ in the world when Jesus lived and died and lived again and then went up to heaven, a story of a community figuring out how to remain in the world when all around us things seem hopeless. This is the story of the community of Jesus' followers. The second text that we heard earlier is a long prayer. Milton also summarizes it nicely, but I'm not going to read it for you. This long prayer is at the end of what's called the farewell discourse in John. It is part of John where Jesus has come to Jerusalem for the Passover. He spends chapters 13 to 19, so the chapters before and the chapters after, replacing institutions and beliefs and ushering in a new way of being in John. And it is in this long monologue where Jesus appears to have four objectives: to comfort and reassure his disciples, to explain where he's going and why. Though the prayer was read really lovely and calmly this morning, I like to think when I was reading it that Jesus is rather desperate when he's praying this prayer. He knows his time is coming, and he's really earnest, and so he's putting everything in it that he possibly can. He's praying to teach, to warn, to build up the disciples for what might be coming, to encourage them to carry on the work of God in the world. That's a big task for a prayer. It reminded me of one of my pastoral care professors in seminary in Chicago who would have hated this prayer. He felt so strongly that instructions and warnings and teachings were not to be part of prayer. Those were part of discourse of the pastor, but they weren't part of prayer. He felt like that kind of prayer put too much pressure on people. And so in my pastoral care class, when we practiced our pastoral prayers, he would interrupt us and say, "No, that doesn't belong there." He wanted prayers to be comforting, to be blessing, to be praising God. He felt like when you put too much in a prayer, it doesn't give the listeners a chance to engage, to question, because it's prayer, not teaching. In this story, in Jesus' desperate prayer that my professor wouldn't have liked, I think, again, it shows some of the ordinary human nature of Jesus. Of Jesus who perhaps wanted to do too much. Jesus who was saying too much. Gone are the short parables, packed with teaching. Instead, we have a person who's maybe afraid of what's coming and doesn't think that his disciples can handle it. This is a person who longs and hopes that those closest to him will be faithful companions to each other, that they will stay in it when the work gets hard, that they will support each other when they don't know what comes next. This text, like the like the other one, are about this in-between time. Jesus is ready and prepared to go to die in John. It is again liminal time and space, in between. The first story is after the ascension and right before Pentecost. That is where we are in the church calendar. Like the disciples in transition, we are too in an in-between time, in a liminal space. Hopefully, we are holding that liminal space as a spiritual position of transition. Though collectively, we are not moving from death to life, that is happening for some of us. Collectively, we do have a lot of questions with changes in staffing, within our building, within ourselves. Some people call liminal space thin space, the time when we are closest to God. In our ordinary human transitions, we have an opportunity to draw intimately close to God. There was a time when I was in incredible liminal space, as I'm sure you may have experienced in your lives. We all have times when we feel alone and confused. For me, one of those most concrete times was a time when my marriage ended suddenly, and I didn't know which way was up. I felt like I didn't know what was going on in my life. I didn't know where to go. I reached out to the community around me and to the community of saints that came before me. I was directed on a number of occasions to the mysteries of Julian of Norwich, who says that most difficult thing, that all will be well and all will be well. In that time of great pain, I was moved by this woman's reassurance, this woman who had lived years and years and years before me. And I was directed to this song, this YouTube video, which I listened to over and over. And we can hear it, but we can't see it.
Loud are the bells of Norwich, and the people come and go. Here by the Tower of Julian, I tell them what I know. Ring out, bells of Norwich, and let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know. Love like the yellow daffodil is coming through the snow. Love like the yellow daffodil is Lord of all I know. Ring out, bells of Norwich, and let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know. All shall be well, I'm telling you, let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know. Ring for the yellow daffodil, the flower in the snow. Ring for the yellow daffodil and tell them what I know. Ring out, bells of Norwich, and let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know. All shall be well, I'm telling you, let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know. Loud are the bells of Norwich, and the people come and go. Here by the Tower of Julian, I tell them what I know. Ring out, bells of Norwich, and let the winter come and go. All shall be well again, I know.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
I watched this video, which you can't see, but I watched it over and over and over again. It's not a very popular video on YouTube. It maybe has 3,000 views, and I maybe watched half of them. And it's these two ordinary women just singing this song. And I found it so meaningful. Both the message of Julian of Norwich and the two of them singing this song. The difficulty of Julian's message is one that she can't explain in detail, because she had this encounter with God where the thing that she was told was just, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. I don't think her confidence was the cheap optimism of one too young or fortunate to have suffered. She lived through the Black Death, which killed almost a third of the population of Europe in between 1348 and 1350. And she endured a painful and nearly fatal illness, which is what led her to her life of faith. Julian taught that all of our pain must be seen in the perspective of the smallness of the world, which is in the comparison to the greatness of God's love. I don't think that says anything about the smallness of pain. It only says something about the greatness of God's love. Later, as I learned more of Julian, she is the one who celebrated Mother Jesus. And her feast day, conveniently, is on May 8th, always near Mother's Day. Julian is often listed with the LGBTQ saints, not because we know that she was queer, but because she has these gender-bending visions of Jesus and God. She also wrote, "As truly as God is our Father, so truly is God our Mother." Julian allows the omnigendered idea of God and Jesus to expand our idea of who God is, of what it means to mother. Her discussions of Jesus as mother sound radical even now. And they for sure, I imagine, did 600 years ago. This is the Jesus who prays this desperate prayer, who wants the best for his disciples. In those years after this incredible time of pain, and before I became a mother, for many years I imagined I wouldn't be a mother. But I still cared for other people's children. It was painful, as it is when we have a vision for life that is not what we thought it would be. Like the disciples who had a vision for life with Jesus, and then it was not, and then it was, and then it was not. But I found it meaningful to connect to the community and to care for other people's children, and it was beautiful. Because to engage with children, to raise children, to welcome them, and create a refuge for each other's children and for each other in the church, that is a defiant act of hope, especially in liminal times. In these past weeks, we have heard of the ways that Jesus' friends gathered with him, the ways that they created space, the ways that they supported him and walked with him. We have heard stories that have been silenced and quieted, stories of women, stories of Mary Magdalene, of Thomas, and I also think of Mary, Jesus' mother. And each of us, whether single, married, parents, or not, we are called to mother, to parent, to bear Christ's life into the world. Lauren Winner, who's the author of Mudhouse Sabbath, she says, "Jesus' birth and death and resurrection set a pattern for our own embodied living. In bearing life, we emulate the author of our faith. Jesus gave life with his body, with his obedience to God. He gave life when he fed, he healed, and encouraged people and told them the truth. If we want to be like him, we will nurture as he did on earth." In the next weeks, we will continue to celebrate in our context what it means to be faithful companions. Like the ordinary disciples Matthias and Barsabbas, who is called Justus, who we don't know of, but who joined with the disciples, we join together with our community. This morning, we welcomed Danny and Eliana, as each of you, I hope, are welcomed. We have walked with Jesus to death and seen glimpses of a new kind of life, This cycle happens over and over again in our lives. It happens over and over in our church community and over again in the world. There is death. There is loss. There is always loss. And sometimes there are glimmers of hope. And maybe life in a new way. Dare we say resurrection? And then ascension? And then we see Jesus among us, and he is gone, always gone. And so we join together, like the disciples, the ordinary folk, and we will celebrate Pentecost next week, the beginning of the church, and our church in particular. We will celebrate the Holy Spirit, wisdom, and her movement within our body and our community. And we will witness in a short number of weeks to the life of faith. You can anticipate celebrating the birth and dedication of Ada Yoder Smucker, the growing faith of our first graders as they receive their Bibles, baptism as entry and commitment to this way of faith as we celebrate with Jeremiah Chico, and then the farewells and blessings as we say farewell to those who have been with us for a short time and are moving on to new callings and adventures. These ordinary stories, these practices of being together in church, this is the story we tell here. It's the story of the birth and life and death and life again of Jesus and of each of us. It's the story of our connections and our frailties. It's the story of faithful companions, the ordinary, the hurting, the loved. It's the story of the way we gather together. And we claim that this place, this particular place, is one of those places in the world that we encounter God, in this in-between and liminal space. And this, my friends, is very good news.